Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behavior in a practical, fun, and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting, or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well. What tips do they have for you and I? And I quiz them about how they apply their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. This is episode 12, and my guest today is James Garrett. James is the founder and CEO of Brain by Design, a US-based organization that teaches strategies for getting more from your mind. He's a psychologist, a former academic, co-founder of a highly successful social venture, Think Unlimited, which taught innovation and creativity to young people in the Middle East. And he's here today to share his passion and knowledge in using our brains to enhance our productivity, manage stress, and live our best lives. Welcome, James.
Thank you, Ellen. Great to be with you.
I'm very excited that you are here. Now, can you tell our lovely listeners whereabouts in the world you are right now?
Yeah, I'm in a lovely little town in the state of Utah, in the southern state of Utah, pretty close to Las Vegas. People would probably know Las Vegas, but I'm sort of surrounded by a bunch of national parks. It's a city called St. George.
Beautiful, beautiful. I don't think I've ever been to Utah. I may have passed through. I remember doing a tour of that kind of area, including Las Vegas, many, many years ago in my very early 20s. Mm-hmm. But I do believe that Utah is a very, very spectacular place.
Yeah, it's very beautiful. Yeah, and we're in this sort of area. People will often do like the Grand Canyon, Zion National Park, Arches. These sort of, I'm right in the heart of those national parks here.
Wonderful, wonderful. Okay, well, it's lovely to have you here, speaking from across the oceans and time zones and all kinds of things. James, what is Brain by Design, your organization? Can you tell us a little bit about it and its purpose?
Yeah, you bet. So in a nutshell, I'm really passionate about taking the best brain and behavioral science and really making that tangible, understandable, practically useful, and relevant for people's lives. You know, I think one of the biggest challenges I saw when I was doing research years ago was that there really wasn't a bridge from getting science out of the labs and into people's lives. I think positive psychology as a movement has sort of, you know, been at the forefront of that conversation. How do we actually implement this? How do we apply this? How do we get into schools, into homes, into companies? But many, many years ago, it didn't seem like that was, the conversation was more like, how do we do more science, which of course is always needed. But I could see this gap, right, between the science and the application. And so I've been spending the last 10 or 15 years trying to bridge that gap. I think that's really my passion. And so Brain by Design is trying to help both individuals and organizations to enhance sort of, I think almost like an upgrade to your brain, right? Our brains are these incredibly powerful machines. And yet we're not really that good at, or we don't really, they don't come with a user's manual, right? And so it's really on us to kind of figure out how they work, and science can help us with that.
Okay, so very much, well, it's a passion after my own heart, this idea of taking what psychologists know and making that useful and usable to the everyday person. And so you do that via an online program, which I'm going to ask you about in a moment, but also through consulting to organizations. Is that right?
That's correct, yep.
Okay. Yep. And I love the name Brain by Design.
Thank you.
There is something about our brains, our minds that we can take control over, you know, through learning these skills, understanding this knowledge, we get some power and we're actually able to some extent shape the way our brain works, or certainly the way we use it.
Yeah, I think it's really both. You know, it's definitely the way we use it, but it also, because of that use, and you know this, I'm sure very well, in neuroplasticity research, we've now learned that the brain is deeply sensitive to experience. And so you'll wake up with a different brain tomorrow than you had today, just based on how much the brain is constantly changing, depending on what we're learning, depending on the experiences we're having, depending on how we're focusing our attention. And so if you can get in the driver's seat of that process, you know, if you can get good at directing or designing that process, as opposed to kind of letting it happen by default, I believe sort of across the board that we all live well below our potential. And part of tapping into that potential, I think, is getting good at maximizing what we already have upstairs.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a really empowering way to think about it, isn't it? That, you know, these brains don't come with a user manual, which might feel a little disempowering, but by learning these, what are in many ways pretty simple techniques and applying these bits of knowledge that, as you said, psychologists and neuroscientists and other researchers have come to discover and really get a much greater and deeper understanding of over the last 10, 15 years, maybe, that we can then use that plus this idea of this plasticity of the brain that we can, you know, shape what we learn based on or how our brain works based on what we learn and what we do. That does give us an enormous amount of control or a sense of control, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the best examples I think of this is our attention, the skill of directing and harnessing our own attentional capacity. We know that meditation and other, you know, skills or practices help. It's almost like, you know, weight training for our brain, right? I sort of think of it as like an attentional six pack, but attention is this massive, you know, William James said, our experience is what we agree to attend to. And so there's this sense in which our entire lives are actually filtered through that attentional lens, if you will. And so if you know that, and you know that other things, like you can turn on your neuroplasticity by literally just turning up the volume on your attention, then suddenly things like meditation, of course, they relax and calm the body, which is wonderful, but it's also a pretty intense form of mental training. And it's not just meditation, it's also things like single tasking as opposed to multitasking. So given the way most of us sort of interact, for example, with the internet, we've got, you know, multiple tabs open all at once. We've got multiple windows. I just read a statistic yesterday about the average person checks their emails 36 times an hour.
An hour.
36 times an hour. I know. I read it too. This is from Adam Alter's book, Irresistible, which is a fabulous book. Adam Alter's an NYU psychologist. But there was a, it's shocking, right? How fragmented actually our attention is. There's a beautiful quote by Nicholas Carr, the author of The Shallows, who said, the internet seizes our attention only to scatter it. And ever since I've read that, I've never been able to get that image out of my mind that there's this kind of, it's almost like a war for our attention, right? Because attention is the most precious and kind of priceless thing we have as humans. And to be empowered to be deploying that very valuable resource in very particular ways is how we kind of express our unique humanness, right? This is what we have that maybe animals don't. Is consciousness, is this ability to direct what we're paying attention to. And out of that grows our creativity, our sort of presence with each, our connection with each other. Out of that grows the effort that we invest in our sort of creative contributions in the world. You know, whether that's building a podcast or whether that's, you know, building a new piece of code or technology, all of that comes out of, it's almost like they're all gifts from attention. And so being in the driver's seat of that attentional, kind of the attentional seat of your mind gives you amazing abilities. And without it, if you're sort of at the whim of all of these other forces that are vying for your attention, then your life on some level ends up being lived for you by other people's priorities as opposed to your priorities and your what you were trying to create.
So that really is that simple, well, seemingly simple idea that we can really harness something as straightforward as our attention, perhaps using something like meditation in order to control so much of our experience, both that daily kind of moment by moment experience, but also our pursuit of our goals, our pursuit of our projects, our contribution back into the world, which is an amazing way to think about that power that we have over our brain, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, and I think we sort of undervalue it. Even things like the way offices are set up. So open office floor plans are very trendy, at least in the United States. And there's a few reasons, right? One of they're economical. They're very cost efficient. But the other one I think is it sort of gives the experience of flattening power hierarchies. And of course, there's a lot of trend toward this in tech companies, but the costs of a sort of chronic state of being interrupted is just vast in terms of our ability to focus. You can't, you know, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi in his books on flow is pretty clear on this, right? You can't really stay in flow if you're being interrupted. Concentrated focus is like a precondition to flow. And so if your colleague is, you know, very kindly, but still interrupting you in the middle of something that you were a deep problem you were really trying to solve, you know, it can take you, you know, there's research out of UC Irvine right now saying it takes you about 25 minutes to get back onto the task and fully absorbed in that task that you originally work on. So people can interrupt us from the outside, and we can interrupt ourselves by this sort of checking compulsion.
Yes.
There's that sort of dual problem, right? So it's not that people mean they're not trying to break each other's sort of flow states. It's simply that we just misunderstand how fragile attention is and that it's really the heart and soul of things like productivity.
Yeah, I think that's a really excellent point, because I know, and similarly in Australia, the move towards open plan workplaces and even beyond that now to this sort of activity-based working and, you know, constant kind of the idea of being able to adapt the way you work to the location that you're working in, which I'm actually working with a client I'm hoping that by creating workplaces that have quiet pods and that have separate, you know, they're still open plan, so we get the benefits of that collaboration and the reduction in that hierarchical structure that you mentioned,
yes,
or perception around that at least,
yeah,
but by starting to understand some of these elements like the need for quiet, the way our brain operates when we're at our most productive, the need for environments that promote and enhance creativity, starting to understand what those are and then being able to, I suppose it's perhaps the next generation of an open plan workplace that creates these particular environments where these things are allowed to flourish so that we are more productive. Because I think those interruptions, as you said, on one hand, and then the second part, which I'm guessing is where you're coming at in terms of the work that you do, is helping people to understand those self-interruptions, the behaviors, the elements perhaps of our digital environment, but perhaps too just our thinking. Would that be right? Is it partly our thinking that interrupts our processes of focus and attention and therefore productivity?
Yeah, for sure. You know, it's interesting. I've been meditating, you know, somewhat seriously for about 2.5 years now. And in all seriousness, just from a personal experience with the practice, I feel like it's changed my own brain pretty dramatically. I just have experiential evidence, just my subjective experience of how much I do or don't feel in control of my own attention. But from that perspective, it's been pretty, it feels dramatic from when I started. And I do think, but it's a very slow process, right? And as it is with physical exercise, you know, the changes are quite gradual. And so, and they're cumulative, they build up over time. And so I couldn't have necessarily predicted how it would feel when I began, but now that I'm on this end, and I still feel very much like a novice. I know there are others that are well
further down the track,
well beyond what I can do. But I've been shocked actually at how much of a difference it's made in this way, where I feel like I don't have those sort of interruptive thoughts, right? Or if I do, I can at least see them, know what's happening, and depending on my sort of state of kind of willpower depletion or charge, let's call it, my sort of mental energy, I will either realign and refocus on kind of what I was already working on so I don't jump to a new tab or whatever that looks like. Or if I do go for a distraction or an indulgence that in that way, I know exactly what I'm doing. It's very conscious, right?
It's my choice at this point.
I'm watching some entertaining clip on YouTube or whatever that is.
Yeah. Okay. So that's really interesting. I have just started. Look, I've done yoga for many years and I've learned a lot about the mindfulness element and the process of meditation. Obviously, I've done all the reading and spoken to lots of people about mindfulness and meditation and the benefits of it, particularly from a well-being point of view. Yeah. But this attentional element is slightly different. And I've just started again. I have dabbled and not found the right path to formal meditation for me yet. So I've just, one of my colleagues here in Australia who I interviewed for the podcast a little while ago, Dr. Susie Green, recommended an app called One Giant Mind, which kicks off with a 12 day program. So I'm on day 10 of my 12 day program.
Yeah.
I'm about 2.5 years behind you.
No. Yeah. No behind or in front.
Yeah, look, I find it interesting because I think even in that small amount of time, I am starting to notice a difference as well. And it's consciousness of my thoughts, not so much the content of the thoughts, but that experience of your brain wandering off when you're supposed to be doing something else and the ability to notice that and bring it back to the task at hand.
Right.
So I think I'm already finding that experience or noticing that experience. And I suppose I'm interested from your point of view, being, 2.5 years down the track and really, feeling that this has made a significant difference. Do you feel that you are more productive now than perhaps you have been, or procrastinate less, or how does this actually play out for you?
Yeah. Actually, now that I'm reflecting on it, I started about June 2016. So it's been almost exactly 2 years. That's about the time. So no, I would say, and it hasn't been a ton. I actually can add up the hours because I use a very particular app, and it's not like when you add up the amount of hours, it's really not that much time. I don't even know, but it's been a lot of sessions, but they're really only the sort of 10 to 20 minute sessions. They're not long. I would say, one of the things I think it's done in my relationships is like I'll go to a conference and I'll be engaging with someone in whatever they're interested in or whatever the conversation kind of goes to. And what I've found is that I feel it reflected back to me a little bit, meaning that I find that people will sort of tell more of their story, right? They'll open up. It's like it sort of sets others at ease when your mind is in that kind of calmer place. And as their kind of, I guess parasympathetic nervous system kind of kicks in, their calming system of their body kind of relaxes, all of a sudden we're in a conversation where it doesn't feel like anybody's in a hurry. It doesn't feel like there's any agenda. We're literally just exploring an idea, which is the best kind of conversations that we all want to be having, right? It's the kind of conversations I'm always having with my 4-year-old, which are they're just about the world. We're just curious. And all of a sudden, it's as though I just find all of a sudden I'm getting into conversational flow. So I was at the World Happiness Summit in Miami a couple months ago, and this has never really happened to me. In the past, when I would go to a conference, I was like a good conference attendee. I would go to all those sessions and whatever. But I just found at this conference that I was, I would go and start having conversations. And before we knew it, an hour and a half had gone by and I didn't even it literally felt like flow, right?
It's gone, right?
And then suddenly I'm in another conversation and I missed half the conference, which is fine with me. I'll just go back and watch the talks that I missed, and that's okay, because I had deep interpersonal connections with a lot of different individuals that it felt like we really like created the beginnings of a real friendship. And that's, I think that's profound. And I don't attribute it to myself. I simply attribute it to this practice that really is accessible to everyone, you know, and I just use an app called Headspace. That's, yep. That's sort of my tool or my the way that works for me. But it's like that turning up the volume on those attentional muscles in every brain in the world. This is just a natural, these are like the fruits of that kind of a practice.
Yeah, that's quite amazing. That's something I'm going to watch out for now as I go down my own meditation journey to see what the impact is. But I can, just from the way you've described it, and I have the benefit of seeing you, which my audience, the audience don't, but, you know, I can see from your body language and your expression, you know, just how powerful those moments or those experiences have been. And that idea that just by being able to reduce some of that mental clutter, by stop that kind of jumping around type, you know, what the Buddhists would call the monkey mind, getting rid of those monkeys
right.
And allowing things that has, you know, is enhancing attention, but also therefore enhancing relationships and everything that flows from that, you know, in a learning setting like a conference, it's, I suppose, opening yourself up there to deeper conversations about topics that, you know, not only are producing friendships and collegial type relationships, but also opportunities for thinking and learning and bouncing ideas off of each other, which does, again, amazingly powerful, all from this simple, and it really is pretty simple. Like we said, you know, we both have apps, different apps, and there's plenty of others out there that allow you to start to take power over your mind, get into the driver's seat, and through a really simple process that also feels amazing when you do it.
Also feels amazing, great. Yeah.
You know, it can have such an incredible impact. I think that's really illustrated for me, at least, and hopefully for our audience, the power of this idea of you're taking your brain and using it by design.
Yep.
So that's given us some wonderful practical examples, James. Tell us a little more. You have a online program that you run called Brain in Mind, which is another fantastic title. I do like your name, your titles. Tell us a bit about the course itself.
So the course is divided into three different modules, one on productivity, one on habits, and one on happiness. And so they're each 4 weeks long. Within the next week or two, I will actually have sort of an on-demand version of that course. So it'll be sort of a pre-recorded on-demand, and that will be broken into three separate courses. But as I've taught it maybe 10 times now, I do it live. I'll do another one starting May 29th. But I teach them live, so they have a little bit of interaction. People ask questions and that sort of thing. But we go over, you know, I spent a lot of years building it, but I've really tried to digest the latest and greatest neuroscience, you know, behavioral science, psychology around, you know, in the productivity module, we go into how to get more done by working less, which is a crazy idea, but ends up being scientifically true.
I'm going to ask you about that in a moment.
We go into, today I just did a session on willpower and managing that mental battery. We go into distractions and multitasking, how to manage and kind of deal with the realities of the internet and smartphones. Motivation, so self-motivation is now sort of, scientists have discovered, is sort of a learnable skill. Motivation is this kind of mysterious thing, right? We have these on and off days, and how do you get better at understanding what's happening when you're, you know, demotivated? And then how do you actually get to a place where you can kind of self-propel. This isn't what, you know, traditionally has kind of been the, I guess, domain of self-help or the personal development space. We're getting a lot clearer on what does and doesn't work. I think of it sort of as like the science help movement instead of the self-help movement. But then, so that's productivity. We go into habit formation, why your brain loves habits, and why habits are so powerful. You know, if you can get good at that skill, of this sort of meta skill, I guess, of forming and building positive habits, then you really can get good at almost anything. Whether that's learning a language or learning a musical instrument or being a better listener or being, you know, doing every morning, the first 2 hours of your day, you knock out the hardest project. Those kinds of workflow habits, other types of habits really make a massive difference. You know, if you look at writers and artists, they're not so, they live by their routines. You know, they seem a little eccentric. We call them eccentric. but interestingly, you look at Mihaly argues this pretty strongly. They're not actually that eccentric. What they do is, and Scott Barry Kaufman argues this as well, they're really good at guarding their attention. That's what they do. Their routines and rituals are all about creating space where they won't be interrupted in large measure. And they're very good at being in tune with their own energy. And then they follow that ebb and flow. So there's all these paradoxes to creative individuals. But you can get good. It's not random, right? You can get good at actually getting, again, having more of a say in turning up the volume on your creativity. So that's sort of habit formation. And then happiness, we go through positive emotions, we go through mindfulness, flow, and just the general sort of a crash course in positive psychology. So I would describe the whole course as sort of a positive psychology course, if you were to ask me how to summarize it. But it does have these different stripes or these different flavors,
which all tie together really nicely. I mean, we know from positive psychology that, you know, these all do tie together nicely, and there's underlying themes across all of those different areas. But I think it comes across, you know, just so practical. You know, happiness is something that we all aspire to. Habits is a very popular topic at the moment. And again, I think, as you say, and I might quiz you in a moment a little more about the nature of habits, but they're relevant and important. And I think one of the challenging things about habits is we tend to have a negative flavor to many of us because we think about bad habits. We don't think good habits. And then productivity being something that many of us aspire to, enhancing our productivity, or at least feeling like we're more productive. I know on paper, when I look at what I get through and I have to remind myself consciously to do this at the end of every week or even at the end of every day, you know, I can be enormously productive. I do a lot of stuff and I get a lot of stuff done. But even in the doing of that, I don't always feel that I'm productive. I still, because of my negativity bias or whatever it might be, beat myself up because I'm not using every single moment of every single day as effectively and as efficiently as I can. And that's been part of my learning journey, has been around that self-compassion piece involved in that.
Sure.
You know, celebrating successes, realizing what I have done, having a bit of self-compassion and paying attention. And again, it comes back to that attentional idea of being able to say, you know what, actually, last week, for example, I had two really, really busy days. I then presented a really big workshop for an organization, and which was really successful, got some other stuff done in the afternoon. And on the Thursday, I got out of bed in the morning and I went, I can't do anything. I am so tired. I had just, I think, worn myself out.
Sure.
And I actually spent much of the day working with my laptop from my bed, which is something I never, ever do.
Yeah.
But I, again, that awareness thing said, you know what, today, my body is telling me, my mind is telling me that I need to ease off a little bit. And there was that kind of mental challenge of, oh, this is not good. This is not what you should be doing.
Yes.
Allowing myself, as it turns out, it was a reasonably productive day. Just because I just sat and just caught up on the things that I could catch up on using my laptop while I stayed in bed. Not sure this is something I really want to publicly acknowledge, but all of those, you know, there's a bit of mindfulness in there, a bit of self-awareness in there, a bit of self-compassion in there, as well as productivity, and the nature of our energy and paying attention to our energy, which I I'm guessing are probably also themes that perhaps you pull in across these three different realms.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, it's interesting. One of the things I'll find with people I'm working with is this, it's almost like we need permission to give ourselves self-care, right?
Yep, I do.
Yeah, you're not alone. I'm less familiar with Australian culture, but in the States, there's such a doing culture. We're such a doing culture, right? It's go, go, go is sort of the mantra for what it means to be successful, or what that's the formula that leads to success. At least that's what we've always believed. And, you know, when you look at the highest producing individuals, I'm more and more convinced that the ones who last and the ones who make the greatest contributions don't actually follow that formula. The formula that they follow is something more like go recharge, go recharge, go recharge. You know, there's this great story of the CEO of LinkedIn, Jeff Weiner. He takes every day 2 hours, and he breaks it into 30-minute blocks, four 30-minute blocks. And he inserts those 30-minute blocks into his day. And then he tells his assistants, no interruptions. This is my time to schedule nothing. This is my buffer time. This is my thinking time. This time I go for a walk, I take a nap, I do whatever. But this is like, you know, guarded time. And he calls it his most important productivity tool. So here you have one of the most highly successful CEOs in Silicon Valley who has tons of demands on his time. And he takes 25%, assuming he works an 8-hour day, I don't know, but takes 25% of his day and schedules nothing. And then he calls it his most important productivity tool. And he swear this is just, you know, and I think people on this level, so Atul Gawande is another great example of this, very famous surgeon who wrote he's a best-selling author, 3 books. He's an advisor to the World Health Organization. He's a MacArthur Genius Grant Fellow. He's, you know, it goes on, list goes on. He's an NGO, he founded an NGO. Very, very well-known individual. And they've been very known for being very balanced, right? And so the paradigm shift of go, go, go to, yes, go hard, right? You know, when you're in these concentrative states, and again, that's what we know leads to flow and peak states of mental performance, being all in on the thing. It's sort of like it requires an equal, or at least it's like a pause. It's not really stopping. And I think that's part of the problem is we feel like if we walk away from our computer, we're not being productive. We're not doing anything. What are we doing? Well, and psychologists have now discovered that your mind is doing all sorts of things once you walk away, especially if you're not demanding anything from your attentional muscles. So if you go for a walk in the park, we know green space does this in particular now. The evidence is pretty clear on this. But moving your body in almost any way, yoga, stretching, exercise of almost any form, taking a nap in the middle of your workday. The historical examples on this are, they're all over the place. The most, you know, Charles Dickens, for example, used to take two to four hour walks in the afternoons, wandering, right? So Leonardo da Vinci, Walter Isaacson just wrote another biography of Leonardo da Vinci, and there's this great quote. So there's a story where he's painting the Last Supper, right? So Leonardo da Vinci, right? Quintessential Renaissance man, one of the most prolific and productive humans the planet has ever seen. And yet you look at his work patterns, they look nothing like the modern workday.
Which is interesting, isn't it?
Interesting, right? And again, Jeff Weiner, like that goes against everything. If you were to come in my office and you were my boss and I was just relaxing with my hands behind my head, staring up at the ceiling, like there's cultural workplace taboos that we feel like we can't cross. And yet when you look at what, again, really prolific folks have done, they just don't burn themselves out. And so anyway, back to Leonardo da Vinci, so he's painting The Last Supper, and the person who hired him, the patron or the one paying him to paint do the painting, he's like, Leonardo, you're not coming into the office very much lately. Like, I don't hardly ever see you. Where do you go? You need to be making better progress, right? This is his boss, essentially. And so the story goes, he looked at his boss and said, look, he said, sometimes the greatest geniuses get more done by working less. And what Leonardo da Vinci knew by intuition and stumbled upon is that our brain is doing all sorts of work while we're letting it relax. Most of it's unconscious, so we don't experience it. But what happens is once you switch from that stay on task mode, that focused mode, which is what most of us are in most of our workday, and you switch in, the psychologists call it executive mode. When you switch to, I call it creative mode. Scott Barry Kaufman calls it imagination mode. In the literature, it's called mind wandering mode. Basically, you're accessing a totally different part of your brain. They call it the default mode network. So the part of your brain that pays attention, which is right behind your forehead, it literally goes off. If you look at an fMRI machine, it goes quiet. And then you activate this suite of regions kind of deeper in the brain that are your deep problem-solving regions, meaning they're problem-solving in totally different ways. They're much more free associative. They're much more flexible and they're much more playful. So this is why we have our 72% of people report having great ideas in the shower. That seems really random. You know?
It does. But I know it happens to me.
It happens to you. It happens to me. I actually keep I use something called Aquanotes. I keep a little notepad that are waterproof in the shower because I'm constantly having good ideas in the shower and I don't want to lose them, right?
I have been known to jump out of the shower and quickly record things on my phone.
Record, right? Yeah, you've always got to have something there, right? But we know this now. Creativity happens in relaxed states of mind again and again and again. It's like here we are turning up the volume on our workers in our workplaces, the volume on their stress levels. And yet we're sitting here on the other hand saying we're fans of innovation and creativity. Well, if you know anything about the brain science, you know you've got to keep people in relaxed states of mind to have anything creative come out of their brains.
Stress is not good for creativity.
It's not good for creativity. It's not good for mind wandering. You actually can't kick into mind wandering mode. So if you want to actually get good at accessing your creative brain and use it as a recharge so that when you go back to your computer, you've got a full battery and you can do that deep dive again and get into peak states of concentration, you've got to go between these states throughout the day. You can't just stay, an 8-hour day is a marathon for your brain. And we know you can concentrate for about 90 minutes. After that, if you're not at least taking a 5-minute walk, you might as well just kiss the next, couple hours goodbye. I mean, you're going to be highly unproductive, or at least your productivity will be highly compromised. And again, we feel this, right? What happens at 3 p.m.? This is like the deepest, most tired slump of the day, right? This is when our natural biological rhythms are down. And yet we force ourselves to keep working. Why? We're knowledge workers.
It doesn't matter. It was interesting, actually, because I had Dr. Sarah Mackay, who's an Australian neuroscientist. I was actually a New Zealand by birth, but now based in Australia, and she's a neuroscientist here. And she spoke on the podcast about her napping, and the fact that she is a firm advocate of the nap for, again, that productivity. So the way she explained it, which made a lot of sense to me, that we spend a lot of our time fighting the urge to sleep, particularly at that kind of 2:30, 3 o'clock point in the afternoon. And we fight and we fight and we fight and we tell ourselves we're not allowed to do it and this is bad. And we force ourselves to kind of push through. And she said that for her, when she realized that, this was her brain telling her something and that she should act on that. And she therefore went and now takes a 20-minute nap.
Yes.
And this helps not only with her productivity, but she said also her emotional self-regulation. So her moods, you know, kids come home from school and far less likely to be cranky at them because she's just taken this little opportunity to recharge. And so again, for me in there, there's an element of this self-compassion, allowing ourselves, recognizing, and this I can understand, or I suspect is your purpose here when you talk about this stuff, is to give us the knowledge and the skills so that we can start to say, right, I'm not just going to fall into this pattern of behavior that society tells us is the way we should work, or the way we should study, or the way we should enact our productivity. I'm going to take control here, listen to what my body says, listen to what I know the research says, and actually be more proactive in managing my time, my day, my productivity. I will nap if I need to. Yeah. Although, again, keeping the naps, I think Sarah said 20 minutes is sort of what we should be aiming for.
That's exactly right. Yeah,
it's a 4-hour nap.
No, yeah, exactly. 20. So the optimal time to not feel groggy is 20 minutes. You're exactly right.
And walking as well, because I know, I mean, we're talking about giving our brains time to relax. We can force that focus for our 60, 90 minutes, whatever it may be, but then giving our brains a little bit of time off. But my understanding from everything that I've read says that doesn't mean sort of sitting and watching YouTube for 20 minutes as a break, or watching TV, that there are better forms of rest for our minds if we want to kind of produce this level of creativity and problem solving.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So what will happen is your brain is really good at demanding a break. It's really bad at telling you what kind of activity you should be doing during that break.
Yep.
It will crave distraction. So think of it this way. Anytime you have the urge to go on like an internet distraction thing, whether that's YouTube or Facebook or Instagram, or doesn't matter what it is. That's a trigger you should be able to, over time, you'll start recognizing, oh, my brain is asking me for a break. But again, it's not good at telling me what's going to actually recharge my mental battery. And all those activities I just mentioned all require attention.
Yeah.
And so they're actually depleting activities. They lower that mental battery. But going for a walk, you think of it this way, that you can't go wrong if you feel that urge to actually just, oh, there it is, step away from the desk. Just step away from the desk and go walk. And again, you can kind of decide what you're going to do once you start walking.
Yep.
But again, it's that first moment when you feel it. Oh, that's the trigger. If I feel my finger wandering up to open a new tab to surf social media, then it's an if-then plan, right? If I feel that, then I walk away from my desk. And then again, do whatever you want. Go outside. If you have a little track, if you've got a little park nearby, doesn't matter. Just start moving your body. And even 5 minutes has been shown to boost, to come, when you come back, it reorients you. Part of what happens in that afternoon slump is when your brain gets tired, you start losing sight of what the original goal was for the task you're working on. And so you start drifting into, now what was I doing here? And where was I going with this? And suddenly, one of the things it does when you go for that little walk and come back, it like crisps up it reorients your goal. You can see again with fresh eyes, oh, that's what I was doing. And suddenly you have increased boosts of concentration.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense, because I do a bit of writing, and I know if I really slog away at an article or a chapter that I'm writing for a long period of time, when it starts to feel like more and more of a struggle, if I do get up and walk away, I can come back and I can see that not only has my, I suppose, energy, enthusiasm, focus started to wane, but also more than likely I've started to kind of wander off topic a little bit. And the reason I'm finding it so hard to find the words or to find the ideas that I'm working on is because I've actually lost the focus or lost track of what it was I was supposed to be doing. That process of getting up, walking away, coming back, and again rereading it after a little break does reorient me back to, oh, that's right. No wonder it got hard, because I really wandered off topic here and was getting into areas that I haven't yet thought through or started to, you know, examine the research or whatever it might be, and having to come back to that helps.
And the crazy thing about it, and this is a really hard paradigm shift for most people, is that when you're going on break, your brain doesn't turn off.
Mm.
Right. It's not like a light switch that's turning on and off. Like I'm on if my, it is a light switch, but it's turned sideways. It's just switching between two different modes. It's an executive mode or creative mode. So when you're going for that walk, what you're doing is, if your brain knows what it's trying to solve, if you can clearly and consciously define the problem or whatever it is, the objective you're trying to achieve, that's what your conscious brain is good at, is getting clear on what it is you're trying to solve, or whether that's writing a page or a chapter for that day or a blog post or whatever that is. Get clear on that goal, and then literally just go for that walk. And it doesn't, like, so the 5-minute walk is sort of like a burst. The kind of walks I'm talking about now are a little bit longer, right? You can go on 30-minute walks. Mm. You know, when you're doing this sort of deep reflective work where you're trying to be generative in your content, I actually recommend people go on kind of a 90-30 rule, where you're 90 minutes on, 30 minutes off, which isn't really off. It's just a different mode. You're just switching side to side on that light switch.
Yeah, I actually take, and I haven't done it for a little while, you've reminded me to go back to it, what I call a well-being walk, particularly again at that sort of 2:33 in the afternoon point of the day, because it's usually 2 kilometers, which is about 30 minutes of walking, and I might pop in a podcast or something, and I'm quite often amazed at how my brain, and I guess it is that mind-wandering mode that you spoke about, that my brain will start to not only synthesize perhaps what I'm listening to, but with the ideas of things that I was working on or new things will pop in, and problems that have felt, especially content type problems, you know, idea type problems that I've been working on, or work type problems I've been working on, solutions, they just sort of pop in there occasionally, not every time,
but something
that I'm listening to will just add a whole new perspective to a problem I was trying to solve. It feels serendipitous in lots of ways, but incredibly powerful. And yet you're right. We're not taught to do this. We're not encouraged to do this, particularly in conventional workplaces. Mm-hmm. I'm starting to hear workplaces talk about walking meetings, which, you know, when I'm working with organizations, I'm a great proponent of the walking meeting, because it's physical exercise. There's that relationship connectedness component with other people, the nature component, and then this idea that we are more creative, which I think I've read some research recently that came out of Stanford that said that we are more creative when we walk, when we're just physically moving from one place to another. And yet we tend to think that, well, to work, I must sit at a computer effectively for 8 hours a day, possibly even eating my lunch, you know, sitting in this same spot. And then we expect ourselves to be, you know, productive and problem solving and creative, but also physically and emotionally well. It makes no sense when you think about it, the more you learn about this stuff.
No, it really doesn't. In fact, one of the questions I'll pose to when I'm doing trainings or talks is, where are you when you have your best ideas? And almost without fail, nobody says at their computer.
Yeah, because no one has good ideas at their computer.
Right? They're like in the shower, on a drive, when I wake up in the morning, whatever, you know. And again, it's sort of like, if we think it's random, but it's not. Your brain has a very particular way that it works. And if you can get good at sort of harnessing that power it has innate to it, and learning to kind of unleash that creativity and go between this executive mode, creative mode throughout your day, then suddenly all this, you're like, wow, I didn't consider myself that creative of a person, but I'm like exploding with good ideas.
And happier for it.
Happier.
I think that's one of the other things that we forget often, when particularly in workplaces, that, you know, it's somewhere we spend such a large proportion of our time. The people we work with, if you work a full-time job, you could spend more time with the people that you work with than you do perhaps with anybody else in your life in terms of quantity of hours.
Yeah.
And yet our focus on well-being, and I mean, it's starting to change. I'm not sure a lot of it, certainly not in Australia, is terribly informed by the science yet, when we talk about workplace well-being. But, you know, it really is such a, and I can hear just by speaking to you, and I know it's a personal passion for me to be able to actually allow people to benefit from work in these positive ways, in these ways that encourage engagement and flow and good relationships and productivity and understanding of ourselves that, you know, work has not traditionally had a focus on at all.
Right. Well, you start realizing, wait a minute, you could actually get more out of your people, have them be happier and more engaged, have better ideas, allow them to work on, you know, one of the things that's really restorative when we take these breaks is growth. Like, you know, whether that's meditation or whether that's playing a musical instrument or whatever it is, but some micro growth, right? Something in those breaks that you can actually do, all the while your brain is still processing the problems at work, and get more done. It's like an equation that, again, on the face of it, unless you know the science, it seems really heretical. It seems crazy. You know, we have these sort of taboos that run so deep that you really got to understand the science or else it just sounds crazy. But the more you unpack the science, you're like, oh, wow. And it is happening, right? Google, you look at the way some of these folks are. I mean, right now, Google, Zappos, Ben and Jerry's, Uber, Nike, they've all got nap pods in their offices now. And it's no surprise. They just know the science, right? And again, 10 years ago, that would have been unheard of. But yeah, now it's like, even 5 years ago, right? So sleep science has matured. It's finally had its day. And I think, so Daniel Pink in his book, When, is arguing that the science of breaks is about where sleep science was 5 years ago. And so we'll see this start surging in terms of our sort of collective consciousness about the value and power of taking mindful, deliberate breaks that both increase our productivity as well as our wellness.
Yeah. And I think, and this is not a conversation for today because it'll launch us off into another hour or so's discussion, but one of the challenges that I've had when I talk to organizations and workplaces about some of these notions is still there's a reticence, I think, sometimes amongst leaders to have faith that people will do the right thing.
Sure.
If given these opportunities, you know, sure, that if given, you know, if nap pods are put into the workplace, that people won't just sort of fall about and go, oh, I'm not doing any work anymore. Mm. You know, I'm going to spend all afternoon napping because the boss said I could. I know in Australia that is still quite a mental hurdle for people to get past. And I know a lot of it has to do with workplace culture and styles of leadership and all of these other complex factors in organizational systems. But I think having a science basis to it, I think the work that you're doing and actually being able to lay that out to people will go a long way to helping overcome some of those hurdles, to help people understand that this is not just someone's wacky idea, that there is, you know, significant substance to this that we know contributes to, as you said, all of those things around productivity, but also well-being, health and happiness.
Yeah. Thank you. And yeah, that's right. And I completely understand those concerns. I often will tell people, look, I get those concerns. Start small, right? Don't bite off too much here. Take those first baby steps. Do 5-minute breaks, right? Every hour or so. Just make it sort of a ritual in the company. We just go for a walk every five. It doesn't have to be in lockstep, right? Just that going on like walking breaks becomes just a kind of thing. One of my companies I've been working with does this now, and they're having amazing results with it. And again, they're not long breaks. Start with those 5-minute walks, so you're not taking too much time, right? And then just see what happens. Just kind of experiment with it at that little level, and then again, you can kind of explore from there.
Yeah, I love that. That's that kind of test and learn. I always talking to people about test and learn. Just try something small, see how it goes. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, try something else. See how that goes, which I think is probably, well, again, we know as psychologists that when it comes to changing things, you can't change everything in one big leap. It's really interesting from organizational perspectives that when we talk about organizational change, there's this idea that we'll just do this, you know, we'll implement this plan and then the whole of the organization will change from what it is to what we want it to be. And yet that is so contrary to how change happens or how we know as psychologists change happens. Change doesn't happen in giant steps. It happens in small increments,
right?
As long as there's a process of measuring and monitoring as we go along.
Yep.
James, there's a whole heap of other things I'd really love to talk to you about, but one of the things that I did just want to cover briefly, you mentioned in the background that we get everyone to complete a little bit of background, and you said that you read a book a week. How do you go about reading a book a week? Because I love to read and I will read all sorts of things, but I struggle. I feel like I don't, again, perhaps by my own rules, my own shoulds, I should read more. What are your strategies for reading a book a week? How do you go about that?
I'm so glad you asked this. You know, there's this concept in Charles Duhigg's book, The Power of Habit, where he's talking about, I think these are his words, he calls them keystone habits. The research has its own term for it. But reading for me has become my kind of keystone habit. It's sort of the central anchor around which the rest of my routine, my morning routine, the rest of my day kind of revolves. And when I'm on, everything else goes really, really well. And if I'm off, I feel out of sorts. I'm not as much myself. But it wasn't an easy habit to form. It took me about 3 months until it was sort of stable. It came about, there was a story to it. I for years and years, I wasn't reading as much as I really wanted to, you know. In fact, it was really, really low. And I found myself getting sucked into reading the New York Times for hours on end, late at night when I was really depleted. I was doing light internet reading, I would call it, right? And there came a point where I knew I had hundreds of books I really, really wanted to read. And I knew that was sort of being, there was like this moment of choice. And so I said, I'm just going to try it. I'm going to try to read a book in a week. I know that sounds crazy, but I still remember the moment that I finished. It was about 12:30 a.m. on a Sunday night. Well, I guess it's Monday morning. And I finished a book called The Willpower Instinct. And I read that last page on the seventh day. And I said, oh my gosh, it's possible. I had this surge in self-efficacy. I had this surge in confidence. Like, oh my gosh, I could do it again, right? It really is possible. I can do this. And then again, I went on this sort of 3 month journey where I really had to, and it's not easy. And I, on some level, it's a little bit crazy. It ends up being about 35 pages a day, depending on the length of the book. So for me, the only way I can get it to work is I've got to get up at 6, and then I spend, my morning routine is almost purely reading. And then I exercise a little bit later in the day. So, and my 4-year-old gets up about 7:30. So I've got about an hour and a half window in the morning where I can get about 2/3 of that reading done. And again, I'm not reading fast. I'm reading reflectively. I'm reading, I'm reflecting, I'm writing. It's an in-depth reflective process for me. But I also have a few rules. I never read anything I don't want to read. I keep it mysterious enough because I know there's a novelty seeking bias in our brain where I won't choose the book I'm going to read for the next week until Sunday night. So I've got my bookshelf and I always keep it fresh. I'm always going to the bookstore. I'll go to used bookstores, different things, just to keep my selection fresh as well. Reading is such a hard chore. It's got to feel fun, you know? And I don't do any book clubs. I know that some people really love the social aspect of that. And if that works for you, that's wonderful. But for me, it's all about intrinsic motivation. I've got to love what I'm reading. And I've fallen in love with the brain and behavior. And so most of what I'm reading is in that area. But I'm pretty particular about what I read and how I read. And then I'm pretty unforgiving about just hitting it every day. And what's happened is my brain's just adapted. So whenever I have a downtime or I'm waiting to pick my daughter up from preschool or whatever, I've got 5 or 10 minutes in the car. What, guess what comes out? It's my book. It's not my phone.
That's great, isn't it?
And it's
how many times during the day you could actually focus. And it comes back to all that stuff we're talking about in terms of attention and managing your mind and habits. And I can see this is kind of pulling a whole lot of things together of saying, right, I will make a conscious choice here. And create that habit, not only around reading in the morning, but also, yeah, then not electing to just randomly and mindlessly scroll through the phone to say, this is the snippet of time that I've got to do to pursue my reading habit and reading joy.
Yeah. And I love it. And I almost feel like every time I read, I feel like a kid in a candy shop. I'm so in love with what I read all day, every day. And I really do enter into these states of flow. I almost feel like I've been living in flow since I started this goal for years. It feels that enjoyable to me. And it's hard, you know, there's no question about it that it's hard at times. And so I don't know, you got to figure out what works for you. Sometimes I say, if you want to try something like this, start with a book every 2 weeks or something, which is a little bit more manageable. But again, the freshness of it, the going through a book every week, there's something about the system. And it's not a complex system. I actually track it. So I have a little bookmark every day. I mean, it's literally like I have a post-it note. And like, this is 31 pages a day. You can see I do the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And then I actually, with my cat, you know, I'll add up what page I need to be on for each of those days. And I put a little check mark every time. So there's these little reinforcers of progress, the sense of I'm hitting it every day. And I think that makes a little bit of difference.
And it's working.
And it is working, yeah.
James, you've given me a little list of, you've mentioned a couple of books that you've enjoyed, and obviously you are a prolific reader these days, so that I can only imagine that your bookshelf would be just heaving with amazing and interesting books to read. You've given me a little list of a couple of your favourites, Dan Pink's When, which you mentioned. Which, and I haven't read When yet. I'm going to. It's on my list of books to read, but I loved Drive, of his previous books. So Adam Grant, who I also love and follow regularly and frequently, his book called The Originals.
Yeah, no, anything by Adam Grant. I'm a huge fan. Give and Take, Originals. Option B, I think, was his one on resilience. So Adam Grant is a master synthesizer, and I feel like the sweet spot of the best science writers are the best storytellers, and they're masters of weaving stories and data, and they write so beautifully, and it's really it's a rare find, right? Daniel Pink is one of them.
Yeah.
Adam Grant, the Heath brothers, Dan and Chip Heath, Gretchen Rubin, there's Sean Acor, there's a handful who do this really well.
Okay. And the other one that you've given me is Eric Barker's book, Barking Up the Wrong Tree.
Yeah. So Eric Barker he originally started as a blogger. He still has one of the most well-known science blogs out there. But this is, if you want a crash course in the sort of science of, let's call it success, which is mostly, you know, sort of field of psychology and related sub or fields. Eric Barker will just take you on a whirlwind tour of that whole world. And it's in such a way, it's so entertaining to read. You literally can't put it down. It's an excellent book.
You've just added that to my long list of books to read.
Okay.
James, I'm going to put the details of those books and your course and all of your contact details and your website all in the show notes for this episode. I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. I know that we could talk for many more hours, so we may get you back on another occasion to talk in some more depth about this. I think for me, you know, a mutual passion around helping people to understand their brain, helping them to understand their behavior, helping them to take control of those two aspects as well. You know, I think that's come through really strongly as a flavor of today's conversation. I hope people go away with that with a sense that we do have so much more control over this machine you know, between our ears than perhaps we think we do. And simple things like habits, like attention, like meditation, even just observing your energy levels throughout the day and saying, right, I get a choice in what I do now and how I do it. Go for a walk, take a nap, read a book, whatever it might be, and you know, see what flows from that. Notice the changes in your productivity, your creativity, your sense of well-being, your sense of calm, your sense of happiness, because I think there's a heap in there that you've shared with us that could really make a significant difference to everyday life for hopefully every one of our listeners.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Ellen.
You're very welcome. And I will let you get on with your evening now as I get on with my day.
Sounds great.
Thank you, James. I seriously could have talked to James for several more hours, but you're probably glad I didn't. I do hope that you got as much from our conversation as I did and that you're inspired to put some of James's tips into action to harness the power of your mind, both for your productivity, but also for your happiness and well-being. Fellow Potential Psychology team member Jay and I are currently enrolled in James's online course, Brain in Mind. If you'd like to know more about it, please feel free to email me. You can find my contact details on our website, potential.com.au. I'm more than happy to share my experience with you. As always, we'd love it if you'd provide feedback to us on the podcast and share the love around. Ratings and reviews in iTunes are fabulous and we read and appreciate every single one. You can also find Potential Psychology on Facebook and on Instagram, where we share tips, quotes, articles and inspiration for fulfilling your potential. In next week's episode, I'm talking to Karen Young, psychologist, author and founder of the Hey Sigmund website. We'll be talking about her book for children and their grown-ups, Hey Warrior. It's a brilliant guide to understanding why anxiety feels the way it does and where the physical symptoms come from. It's designed to educate and empower kids and turn anxiety around. Here's Karen.
One of the really great things about the last decade or so is we're able to see into the brain. We're able to see why these things, which we just kind of knew worked, but we didn't know why, we can see why they work now. And that's the information I want people to have, because it's really hard to do things unless you know why you're doing them.
Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week.